like to take a theme that we began with a little while ago and try to take that road a little further in terms of the parts of the Torah that we're going through now and experiencing. And that is the idea which we've had occasion to study many times and many of its facets before, that things begin perfect and then there's always a departure from perfection so that the work can be done of getting back to that perfection. I think you remember we said that you see that the world is created that way. Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve are created as one fused being, which is what a marriage is, right? Really. But then they are torn apart in order to fuse back into each other in marriage and get back to, through their own effort and their own giving away of themselves to each other, to get back to that fused entity that they were in the beginning. So the pattern you see in the very creation of the human being is a perfection in the marital sense, that's a unity. Then there's, and we explained in detail that they were fused by the backs, right? You remember that? Yes? No? Yes. Who is not here? No, okay. Where were you? Well, we said that they were fused at the back, so there was only a front. There was a male front, as it were, and a female front. No dark side. The back is always the side of darkness, as we pointed out before. But of course, they couldn't see each other, so they had that version of perfection, which is oneness but no relationship, if you like. And then they were separated to being given the work and the ecstasy, really, and the danger of fusing back into one, but this time a oneness that had been brought about by their own creation, so they become creators of their own perfection, which is the point of the creation of the world. Yes, it's dangerous. It can be misused. The separation can lead to a greater separation instead of a fusion. That's the risk you take in order to give the human being a share in his own perfection. There are many other versions of this. We, on previous occasions, studied the idea that the fetus in the womb, the unborn child, is taught the whole Torah. The Gemara says that the child in the mother's womb is taught the whole Torah. He knows the whole world. He sees the one end of the world to the other. There's a light lit above his head, which means a perception. A light lit above the head always means, you know, if you want to show someone the world, you shine a light on the world, not on his head. So yet it says the fetus sees the whole world from one end to the other, it means in time and space, because he has a light, ner doluk al roisho, a light lit above his head. The meaning, of course, is that the light shines in his head. It's in himself that he knows the whole world. The mitzvah that this leads to, of course, is tefillin, right? That should be obvious. Tefillin is the light lit above the head, right? The tefillin, same word as tefillah, which means prayer, which is a lifting into the higher dimension, like to speak about this evening. The word tefillah is the same thing. It's the repositioning of a light that was once there. All we have of that now is only the empty space that is open when a child is born. When a child's born now, he has bone missing from his head. You can feel the brain pulsate if you put your hand gently. On the head of a newborn, you can feel the brain pulsating, right? There's no obstruction there. Tefillin is a reopening of that opening. Rashi makes it clear, you have to wear your tefillin, not here, you have to wear your tefillin here, in the plate, part of the skull that was once open. It's a reopening of that connection. The Kabbalistic sources say that Adam was created with tefillin as part of his head. He had that aspect of himself as part of himself, his connection to a higher world. Now we have no connection. Tefillin is that reforging of that connection. But the child has that light lit above his head. And he sees by it from one end of the world to the other. He knows all that he must be and all that he can be and the whole world's potential. And he knows all of human history. He knows all the mysteries of creation. And as he's born, he has a blow on the mouth and he forgets it all. And he's born a simple child who knows nothing, who must spend a lifetime struggling and sweating and bleeding to get back to the knowledge that he once had for free. And why do it that way? Again, if you want the person to have the wisdom, give it to him. If you don't want him to have it, don't give it to him. You give it and take it away. The answer is it always begins, the process begins with perfection. You have always, as part of your consciousness, an intimation of your own perfection and your own greatness. You do know it all. And real wisdom, learning real wisdom in life, isn't really learning new things. It's just re-evoking what was there before. That's why there's a resonance when you learn something that's true. You know it's true because it strikes that inner chord. And that's why when you learn parts of your own Torah, things that are especially meaningful to you, that trigger your chords, because your unique contribution, each of us is a unique piece of that puzzle or tapestry or symphony. And that's why you know things true, and that's, you know, it's your truth, and it's your particular part of the whole entity, because it was once there. And that's why you long for wisdom. People of spiritual sensitivity become addicted to that wisdom, can't live without it. The greatest ecstasy in the world is learning Torah and discovering that wisdom. The reason is because it was once you. And we tried to make it plain before. You can only long for something that really was once you. You can't long for something you had nothing to do with. Why would you long for it? It means nothing to you. You always long for a thing. Man longs to get married because she was once part of him. The Gemara says a man sets about marriage like a person looking for his lost object. She was part of him, his rib, his back, his part of his body. He wants to fuse with her again because he knows what that means. And that's why there's such a sense of fulfillment and perfection in that, because it is his own inner perfection. And so that's the theme. So let's take it a little further this evening and see a particular application of that theme. This is the great theme of history and creation. The Rambam says this. He says that when the forefathers of the Jewish people, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and of course the mothers, he puts it like this in his great work where he describes what they brought to the world. He says this. He says there was a man called Abraham, and he brought to the world, the way the Rambam puts it is like this. When he talks about mitzvahs, he says that when Adam was created, certain mitzvahs were extant in the world. Adam, Noah were given certain mitzvahs. Six mitzvahs as it happens. The original mitzvahs of mankind, not the 613 mitzvahs we were given later as unique Jewish expression, but mankind was given certain obligations, certain commandments, certain spiritual reality by which to live. And then he says this great rock on whom the world was to be founded, called Abraham, came to the world, and he added circumcision, right? Huhesif bris milah. He added the concept of circumcision. That means bringing the body to a particular perfection. Again, the body was not brought into the world perfect. It was spiritually created perfect and brought into the world with imperfection, like we've been saying. You have to perfect it yourself. Even in the flesh, it has to be perfected. And he added that to the world. And then amazingly, the Rambam adds a line. V'hu hitpalel shacharit. That's what he said. Who is hitpalel shacharit? And he prayed the morning prayer. The Rambam's describing the process of Torah. And he describes it like this. Adam and Noah were given certain commandments. Not allowed to steal, not allowed to kill, not allowed to eat a limb from a living animal. Commit idolatry, curse, what we say, bless Hashem, meaning the opposite. If you just move a drop, those people can fit in. If you just move aside slightly, then bring another chair in there. So, these mitzvahs are brought to the world. And when he begins to document the process that became the Jewish people, he says that Avraham Avinu came to the world and he added the concept of circumcision. It brought that into the world as a commandment. And then he says, and he prayed shacharis. Yeah. What does that mean? Why? He did many good things in the world. He accommodated strangers and he fed them. He spread the word of Hashem in the world. I mean, he was indescribably great. But the line that he adds there, he was the founder of what we call shacharis, the morning prayer. That's what he says. And then he says, came Yitzchak, his son Isaac, and he says, "V'hu hifrish ma'isa." That means he introduced to the world the notion of giving away 10% of what you earn, not just charity, not stock, but ma'isa. That means calculating 10% of your earnings and giving that to tzedakah. And he says, and he instituted a new prayer called mincha. But the Torah says that he was in the field when the sun was going down, lifnei sayom, as the day turns into night. And in that darkening of the day, he began a new process and he davened mincha. And then, he says, came along Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, and he added his own component, Gidanashe, which is the prohibition of eating the nerve of the leg. Details not important now. He added that and he added a prayer called Ma'ariv. He prayed at night. What's going on? Why do we need to hear that when these three great pillars of the world brought to the world their great contribution, their spiritual energy, if you like, and the particular mitzvah they brought to the world. And then he goes on to say, and finally, more Torah came down to the world, and in the days of Moshe, of Moses, Hishlimis HaTorah, that means he completed the Torah. First of all, what does that mean, really? The Torah was really began with Adam and Noah and was only completed, was given sort of piecemeal and was completed only. Our Torah that we were given at Sinai is a completion of something of Adam's, of Noah's. What does all this mean? But let's try to focus on one aspect of this evening. What is the meaning of these three prayers? And why are they so closely identified? And why do we need to know that? That each of them brought to the world this unique aspect of tefillah, which is called Shachris Milchama. You know that the Gemara says that the prayers are derived. How do we know about our prayers? How do we know about Shachris Milchama? Because Avos Tiknum, that means the forefathers, established them, which is exactly what we're saying. Avram began Shachris, Yitzchak began Milcha, Yaakov began Mariv, and therefore we know that there are three prayers. The problem with this is that the Gemara also says that the prayers are parallel to the korban, to the sacrifices. Right? Which means that the reason we have a Shachris and the reason we have a Mincha is because there were two offerings brought in the temple, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. And the meaning of our, after all, that's called Avoda. Avoda means service. And prayer is a service, one of the very few English translations that is correct. Almost none. This one happens to be correct, that he called it a prayer service. It means something you serve, you give. It's called Avodah Shebalev, the work of the heart. There's a serving here. Great mystery why it's called a service. After all, it consists of asking for things you want. Why is that called a service? But it is. And it's modeled on the sacrifices, which is the ultimate service. It's a giving up of a life, really, that should have been yours. So the problem is like this. First of all, why are the prayers modeled both on the three fathers of the world and also on the sacrifices? What's the meaning of that? Obviously, both have to be true. Furthermore, there weren't three of those. There were only two. The sacrifices in the temple were only Shachris and Mincha, only morning and afternoon. And yet we have three prayers. What's going on? We're told that do you see the problem? We're told that the daily prayers we have, without going into Musaf and Ne'ilah and various other prayers, which parallel various other great figures, but the daily prayers that we have, Shachris, Mincha, Maariv, morning, afternoon, and evening, they are based on the three figures who brought those concepts to the world, and they're also based on the sacrifices, but there's three of those and only two of those. What exactly is going on? The first principle to know is that people make a mistake about this, is that the prayers that we call Shachris, Mincha, and Maariv are different things. You know, we say the same words. People think it's the same thing three times a day. After all, the composition that we use, right, the wording that was given to us by Sheikh Sagdola, the man of the Great Assembly 2,500 years ago, the words are the same. You have 19 blessings in the morning, they follow a certain format. You have 19 in the afternoon for Mincha, you have the same thing for Maariv. People think you pray three times a day. It's a big mistake. You don't pray the same prayer three times a day. That's categorically wrong. Shachris is Shachris. It's a special work. It's a special effort of the soul. When the day breaks, it has to be said before a certain time. Those words have a completely different meaning in the morning. What's being evinced then, what's being manifest then, is the quality of Avram, of Abraham, the original forefather of the Jewish people, and he brings a thing to the world called Shachris. When you daven Mincha, when you pray Mincha in the afternoon, it happens to be the same words, but it's a different head completely. It's a completely different intention. The intention here is bringing all back home, bringing it all back. The morning is the place where everything goes out. The sun shines, and then things begin to be done in the world. Mincha is a time when you bring it home. It's a completely different head. If the day's been successful, you bring home victory. You bring home what's been earned. It's a completely different concept of what's being said here. And Maariv is a completely different head as well. And that is why there are only two offerings in the temple, but three prayers. Maariv was originally optional. The concept of Maariv, when Yaakov brought Maariv to the world, the concept of prayer at night is a cry of the soul in darkness. It is a reaching out where nothing's clear. That's why it's voluntary. Today it's not. Today it's halachically become an obligation. But the original Maariv, when Yaakov Avinu, when Jacob brought that to the world, he brought to the world the concept of calling out in the darkness that you can only do in and of yourself. You don't hear another voice instructing you. If you could hear that voice instructing you to do it, you'd be in clarity. The point is that you're alone. You know, the night, you have to understand, the night is a time of emunah. Emunah means a time of faith. Faith means you have only what's within. There's no point of reference outside. See, today we don't understand that because we don't have night. We don't have night. Our night is so lit that we don't know what night means. Today we're afraid of the darkness. Darkness is really fearsome. Everyone's afraid of the darkness. People left alone in utter darkness. It's a terrifying experience. Some people pretend they're not. It's only pretending. Some people cope with it better. But everyone's afraid. The concept is, in the daytime, there's an external point of reference. Your existence is validated by an external point of reference. At nighttime, the only reason you know you are because you have an inner knowledge. But all knowledge of the world then at night is only by reference to an inner knowledge. There's no external point of verification. Can't know that it is there. For all you know, it might have all disappeared. Might never have been. That's what's alarming and fearsome about the night. Therefore, there's no commandment to pray at night. There's no one speaking to you. It comes from the, it's a cry of the heart. And that's why essentially the concept of Maariv is that it's a voluntary cry in the darkness. Only somebody who's really experienced darkness can understand this. You know, if you're outdoors in a place where there's no light, no moon, the stars don't give light. The stars you can see, but they don't light anything. You know that. Yemo says that. You're all English, you have no familiarity with this. Have you ever been in Africa? No place here, like, there's no place. You ever been outdoors hundreds and hundreds of miles? A few weeks ago, I was in the Kruger National Park at night, in the bush. Not in the park, in the bush at night. Just a few of us, a ranger, one gun. Not good it would do if a herd of buffalo come through, but. And you march out into the bush at night, and the stars are irrelevant. You see them. You see the stars are amazing. You don't see stars here. Here you see millions, unbelievable. But it doesn't light the ground. The Gemara says the moon does, slightly, somewhat. The stars don't. If you caught, you're out in the bush, if you're trapped out in the bush alone at night, the hundreds and hundreds of miles of darkness around you, it's an amazing experience. Our society doesn't accept that, so we light the night fiercely to escape that. But the day is a time of knowledge, and the night is a time of faith. You don't know things at night. The only way you know them at night is because you know them inwardly. There's no point of reference in real night. We said, "Lagid baboike chazdecha, chesed is in the morning, kindness shines. Ve'emunascha balelois, and your faith at night, all you have at night, is that inner knowledge. And therefore the prayer of night, Maariv, is a completely different thing. It used to be that voluntary calling out. And today it still must have that flavor. Now, why was it so essential? Why is it essential to us that these three great figures each brought a prayer to the world? What? And why is prayer so important? This is the fundamental thing that contributed. That when you document the history of the Jewish people and you tell me where it began, you have to tell that each one introduced a prayer. You know, we like to think about davening, about tefillah, about prayer as a sort of a... It's polite, you know, you should say please and thank you. Hashem gives you life, He gives you what you need. You say please. Afterwards you say thank you. There's a law that when you say thank you, you should say please again. You know that there's a law in davening that if you get granted a request, you should open your mouth in thanks and immediately ask for more. Definitely. After all, the justification is that you want the things you're given to use in Hashem's service. You don't want them for your own personal limited. You want them. And so when you're given what you ask for, and you've asked for it correctly, the correct procedure is to thank Hashem for it and immediately ask for more. Definitely. The simple understanding of course, is when you've been granted it, this is what's called an esrotzen. Esrotzen means it's a time of favor. In England, you call it a good wicket. That's what you call it here. A good wicket. So when you're on a good wicket, then take advantage. So you see Hashem has granted you what you want, so then you ask for more. But we think of it as frills, you know, icing, frills, polite, ask. We have a lot of doubts about it. Does it really make a difference? Is anyone really listening? Very awkward. Very, very awkward for us. So let's try to understand a bit more deeply what this thing is that called, try to demonstrate that prayer is essential. It is an expression of who you are in the world. It's not a sideline, something that you need to put together with natural effort. It is essence. Very hard for us to understand as Westerners and as people living in such a deep darkness. Let's ask a few questions about this very strange mitzvah and practice and see if we can close the circle and come back to where it began. First of all, many questions. We could spend all night asking the questions, but let's isolate a few. You know that our prayer is always, tefillah is always a longing. It's always a longing. You know that the words of the tefillah, when you look in the words that they composed for us, they are requests. You know, the 19 blessings of Shemona Esrei, the format that it takes is the first three are a signing on, as it were. And the last three are a signing off, right? Actually, it's a climbing up, getting into another domain, dimension, and then there's a coming down afterwards. So there are three introductory ones, and there are three closing out ones. But the 13 middle brachas, all requests. They're all requests for health, for wealth, for wisdom. It's true that more or less half are not, so to speak, selfish. That means they're for Yerushalayim to be rebuilt, and for the Mashiach, and for peace. Yeah, for the whole... for what we need, for what we need in order to eat and to survive, for wisdom. And all of them are, to be sure, said in the plural. But nevertheless, they're requests. So here's the problem. First of all, why do we need to pour our heart out in requests? And if that's the format of the tefillah, why do we call it service? Service is exactly the opposite. Service means I serve you. Basically, I give what I can to you to satisfy your need. Request is, please satisfy my need. I don't see anyone out there. Are you with me? Here's the problem. We call it avodah shebalev, the work of the heart, and we call it service. Service means I sacrifice for you. That's what a korban is, a sacrifice. Yes, I come close to you in that sacrifice, but I do it by sacrificing to the life of a living being that should have been mine, and I give that to you. That's called service. Couldn't be more intense. And how do we fulfill the service? I stand in front of Hashem, I take three steps forward, and I'm now about to fulfill this exercise that's called service and giving myself to Hashem. And the words are, Hashem, this is what I need. I want health, wealth, wisdom. What's going on? You call it service and it's a shopping list of your own. I got the chutzpah to call that a service? What's going on? And that's modeled on a sacrifice? Where's the sacrifice in telling him what I need? And if there is a service, it appears that what I want is him to serve me. What's going on? That's the first problem. The second problem is, not in any particular order, how can you tell him what you need as if he doesn't know already? A loving father is going to give what his child needs, whether the child asks or not. So why does asking make any difference? And secondly, this is a father who already knows. What mother is going to send a child off to school on the first day without the teacher says the kid must come on the first day with a ruler and a rubber and a pencil and so forth? Mother's going to send him off without the stuff. Ah, I fooled you. The six-year-old's going to get to class without his ruler and, you know, he's going to have a psychotic breakdown. You know what the child needs. You're going to give him what he needs. Hashem knows far better than any parent what you need. If you need it, he's going to give it to you. And if you don't need it, he's not going to give it to you even if you ask. The child says, Imma, I need certain things. I need an eraser and a pencil and a ruler and a little shot of cocaine. All the kids, all the six-year-olds in my class are here. So the mother's not going to give it. Or you're walking down the street with your little six-year-old and he picks up a jagged, broken piece of green glass from an old smashed beer bottle. And he thinks it's wonderful because you could look at the whole world. The mother's going to take it away. No matter how much the child cries, he's not going to give it. Why? It's dangerous. So if you ask for Hashem for something that you need and he knows it's bad for you, you're not going to get it. What do you think you need? A stable bank? Shares that go up. I mean, what do you think you need? He's saying to you, that's not good for you. No matter how much you think you need it, he's not going to give it. If it's not good for you, what kind of parent would give a child their request, which is dangerous and harmful? We're not going to do that. So if he knows what you need, why tell him? And if he knows what you need, sure, he's going to give it to you. Third, if you do need to tell him what you need, and it has an effect, that's completely impossible. That means he wasn't going to give it to you, but because you asked, he is. Well, you changed his mind. That's what's going on. You changed his mind. You convinced him. Is that what's going on? That means Hashem looks down and he says, yeah, tats. And you say, Hashem, it's about £100,000. And he says, look, I know you think that way, but that's a bad mistake. You have enough money, you're going to forget about me. You know, the thickness of your wallet, Rabbi Miller used to say, is the thickness of the wall between you and Hashem. So Hashem says to you, it's not good for you. And you say, Hashem, I know you think that way, but just give me a chance to make my presentation. And then you spend a few, you know, Shmoneh Esrei, you make a... And then Hashem looks down and he says, gee, I didn't see it that way, but after that presentation... Or to put the thing more deeply, that would be miraculous. That means if you said some words that changed the dispensation, changed God, changed his mind, changed the dispensation by... What's going on? How's that possible? And you know, one way or the other, you're in trouble, because if your words can make no difference, why do you say them? And the words are not simply words of praise. The central work of tefillah is requests. A request is something that you expect to be given because you ask. That's the meaning of a request. So if you know you're going to get it anyway, or you're not going to get it anyway, and you pour your heart out in this request, knowing that it's going to make no difference, it's a very strange exercise that cannot be sincere. That can't be the intention. On the other hand, if you think that your request is going to make a difference, how do you change his mind? And how can you change something that was good for you, that was bad for you, into something, well, what's going on? Another paradox is the fact that the word for prayer in Hebrew is one of those remarkable Hebrew words that mean two opposite things at the same time. You know, there's a class of words in Hebrew that's called davar v'hipucho, something and its opposite in the same word. Many words like that, each one is a fascinating story. But the word for tefillah in Hebrew is a word that means two opposite qualities. The root in Hebrew of that word is palo, palal. That root means something pertaining to the strict, narrow confines of justice. In modern Hebrew, an avon plili, right, is what in English is called a felony. It's something that offends the judicial system. Palo, palal means something, plilim in Hebrew, in the Torah terminology, is something that is a legal damages, something that applies to the legal system. Now, din, din means absolute, narrow, no hair's breadth beyond the purely limited. And yet the same word in Hebrew means something completely beyond any sense of limitations. Like when Yaakov saw Yosef again, Jacob saw Joseph after so many years, the expression, thinking he was dead, 22 years he'd been, he thought his son was not alive. When he saw him, he said, Ro'o panecha lo pilalti, anet pilalti, the same word, I never dreamed of seeing your face again. In other words, on the one hand, the word means something that is circumscribed by the logic, by the absolute limitation, can't move a hair's breadth out of what's possible and what's legally defined. And yet the word also means something so impossible that it couldn't have even been hoped for. Well, how do you have one word that means two opposite things like that? Hebrew is a language of essence. It means this is an exercise that must have both of those. Another mystery, by the way, is that the intention has to be opposite. The intention is, when you ask Hashem, you're supposed to have a paradoxical intention. The intention is amazing. The intention is, Hashem, I'm asking you for this thing. And what I mean is, I want it most intensely. But I also mean that if it's not good for me, or more deeply, not good for you, I don't want it. That means you have to, you know, we have a source for this. It says that when King Solomon built the temple, Shlomo HaMelech built the temple, he offered a prayer. His tefillah was, he asked Hashem that any human being, any non-Jew, who davens through this building, that means who focuses his prayer to you through this thing that we call the temple, which is the place of connection of this world and the next, grant him his request unconditionally. That was his request. I mean, King Solomon prayed. After all, he was the messianic figure. The world was united in peace under him. The only 40 years in the history of the world, basically, when the world was at peace. Kings and queens brought homage to him. And there's an expression of that international unity, which he led. He said, Hashem, any non-Jew who prays to you through this house that I have built, grant his request unconditionally. And our sources learn he meant for non-Jews unconditionally. But a Jewish prayer is supposed to be conditional. That means Hashem, grant this prayer only if it suits, only if it's right and good. But if it's not, scrap it. That means you have to ask Hashem for something only if you can accept the idea that if it's not right, you don't want it. Yeah, yeah. There was a woman who had a child who was ill, desperately ill. She had a brain tumor, 7-year-old boy. So she went to a great Hasidic leader. The name's not important now. It's the last generation. And she sat with the Rebbe and she said, my son's desperately ill. The doctors don't think he's going to survive. I've come to ask you to pray for him. So the Rebbe said to the woman, if you knew that he had to die now, if you knew that Hashem needed, that means in his scheme of things, this child had to leave the world now, could you accept that and give him up? So she sat there agonized over the question for a long time, and then she said, if I really knew that was Hashem's intention, yes, I could give him up. She said, fine, now we can do it. And he prayed and the child recovered. But what he was teaching her was, you can have this if you can give it up. Then you can want it. But if you can't do without this thing, that means it's a personal addiction. You want him to serve your addictions? But very hard for us to hear that message. So a woman was in Yerushalayim. There's a housewife. She was working in the house. Her 6-year-old daughter was playing in the corner with a doll. And as this little girl was playing with her doll, the head came off. It's a heartbroken little girl. The doll broke.
Without thinking, her mother said to her, "Don't Hashem, pray to God, don't Hashem to fix your doll." That's the religious response, right? And then she thought, "What have I done? What have I done? This little child's going to daven and daven with all her 6-year-old sincerity. The doll's not going to get fixed. I've broken her faith. I've destroyed this child's faith." And that's exactly what happened. The child went off and shuckled backwards and forwards, davening with all her fervor. And of course, the doll remained broken. So half an hour later, the mother, with great trepidation, said to the child, "Did you ask Hashem to fix your doll?" And the girl said, little girl said, "Yes." And the mother said, "And what happened?" And the little girl said, "He said no." So if you have that maturity, if you have the maturity to hear no, then you can ask. There's many other mysteries. One of the other great mysteries is that the fact that the word for prayer in Hebrew can only be expressed, or is normatively expressed in Hebrew, in the seventh construction of the verb. You know, the Hebrew verb has seven forms. There's seven forms of the verb, beginning with a simple form. There's seven complex levels of the verb in Hebrew, right? Each of them corresponding to a different Kabbalistic level, different midis in the world. Now, time to go into that now. The seventh of them, obviously, is the reflexive, obviously, where you come back to the self. It's amazing to understand this. Hebrew grammar. Just understanding the Hebrew language is enough to make you frum instantly, I can tell you. So, people don't understand. Some people don't speak Hebrew. They don't know what it is. And those who speak Hebrew, even less connected. Because they speak a completely secular, technical, they've never been shown what's in the language. It's harder even for them to hear. The seventh level of the verb in Hebrew, the simple level, is to do. And as you move through seven constructions of the verb in Hebrew, the seventh of them is to do to the self. Obviously, the seventh is always where the circle is closed. Right? That's called hitpa'el in Hebrew. It means the seventh is always called malchus. Malchus is where the circle is closed in the beginning. The first of the great midas, right, in Kabbalistic language is keser, the crown. The crown is the symbol of rule and it's above the structure. The last of them, when you get down to the feet, is called malchus, malchut, which means kingship. No accident that kingship is the manifestation on the ground of what the crown symbolizes at the root. You've come back now to where the source is. So the seventh level of the verb in Hebrew, hitpael, is where the action is done on the self. For example, in Hebrew, the word lavash means to dress. Lovesh is to dress. Lehit labesh means to dress oneself. In English, you don't have a different... In English, the word is dress. It's to dress myself or to dress. In Hebrew, the simple form of the verb is to dress, and the seventh level, the reflexive, is to get dressed. Now, that's what it is. Clear? Prayer can only be said in the reflexive. Isn't that amazing? In English, you say to pray, right? In Hebrew, the only way you can say that verb is lehit palel. That means I'm doing something to the self here. What am I doing to the self? I'm speaking to God. I'm speaking to God. The essence of prayer is to stand in front of Hashem. Reb Chaim of Brisk famously says that the non-negotiable part of prayer, the essential part of prayer, is to stand in Hashem's presence. That's what it is. You know, it's a very famous analysis here of the Rambam. The Rambam says, a very beautiful point to understand, Maimonides, the Rambam says, in one place, he discusses how much intention must you have. This is very humiliating, very, very humiliating for us. Shows how little concentration we can muster. But the Rambam says, how much must you concentrate on the words? When you're uttering your prayers, you have 19 blessings to say. What's the minimum shear? In other words, if you lose concentration, right, and you break your thought train, and you're mumbling words without thinking, now the normal way it happens is you take 3 steps forward and you say, this time I'm going to mean every single word. I'm going to focus completely right through. And before you know it, you're taking 3 steps back and you've been in Hong Kong or who knows where you've been. Can't even remember where you left off. Sometimes you stop in the middle and don't know where you are. So how much do you have to intend? The Rambam says like this. In one place he says that you have to intend, the halacha is, you have to intend the first three, you have to have kavanah, that means meaning. In the yeshivas they have a joke about this, another humiliating joke. In the yeshivas they say, in the morning prayers in Shacharis, which can take you about an hour, what's the first point where you have to have kavanah, in other words, you have to have intention? The joke in the yeshivas is, hayom yom revi, you know, that's today is Wednesday, which day it is, that's like after you've been through 50 minutes. Anyway. It's funny, but yeah. Because, you know, you can roll out of bed and function on automatic till you get to that point, more or less. The only time you have to think, you know, is... But the Rambam deals with, what is the minimum amount that you have to say that you have to... So you have to mean the first three blessings. If after that you lost concentration, it doesn't invalidate the blessing. Then the Rambam says, actually, the first one is essential. The first one, up to Magen Avraham. And after that, if you lost concentration, it's not good at all. It's a very low thing. You're standing, speaking to Hashem, and you're thinking about something else completely, usually completely inappropriate things. But it does not invalidate your prayer. And then the Rambam goes so far as to say that for practical purposes, even if one goes back and realizes he didn't have intention for the first one, we don't go over it again. The reason is because you'll get it wrong again. Basically. But the minimum amount is you have to have intention for the first, intention for the simple meaning of the words. We're not talking about big time black belt Kabbalistic intentions. We're talking about simple meaning of the words. In fact, it's a spiritual joke for a person who has Kabbalistic intentions when he isn't meaning the simple meaning of the words. So in one place the Rambam says you have to mean a certain amount, namely the first blessing, whatever it is. Elsewhere the Rambam rules that if you miss concentration at all anywhere, the whole prayer is invalid. What he says, a famous contradiction in the Rambam. One place he says you have to mean the meaning of the words only up to a certain very minimal point, and elsewhere the Rambam says if you miss concentration anywhere, the whole thing's invalid. You have to give intention all the way through. Reb Chaim explains in his classic exposition, which is well known in the yeshiva world, there are two different types of concentration. Reb Chaim was famous for showing that what appears to be one thing actually conflates two halachic concepts. Sveidilim, it's called. And he explains most beautifully here. He says this: there are two levels of concentration in tefillah. One is meaning what the words say. Meaning what the words say. If you don't mean what the words say because your mind has wandered after a certain point, it's not invalid. It's bad. It's ill-mannered. You're speaking to Hashem, you're not thinking of Him. Bad. But doesn't invalidate the tefillah. But there's another intention in prayer, and that is that you're standing in front of Hashem. You're speaking to God. That you can't lose ever. You might mumble words. You might lose track of the words you're saying. But amid bifnei ha'melech, standing in front. That's why you have to dress respectfully when you daven. Can't daven in slippers. Or underwear. Crocs. You have to dress like you dress in front of a king. It's amid bifnei ha'melech. You have to... Strictly speaking, you should wear a hat. Hat is a part of the body that's honors the highest part of the body. So Rambam says very clearly, the meaning of the words is one thing, but forgetting that you're standing in Hashem's presence, the essence of prayer, therefore, is simply standing in front of the king. So what is the work here that's being done reflexively? What is this? What is the meaning? And in fact, lehit palel in Hebrew, if you understand the words deeply, the word palal means judgment, like we said before, legal, judgment. Lit palal means there's some judgment of the self that's taking place. That means you are here going through a self-analysis, a self-judgment. What does it have to do with prayer? So let's try to... there are many other questions as well, but let's try to get through some of these. One fundamental question also is prayer natural or miraculous? We said changing God's mind, miraculous. We have sources that say both. Many Jewish sources say that when you ask Hashem for something, you're simply turning on a tap, a faucet. You turn it on, it happens. Just turn the tap. Put another way, make yourself a vessel. There's no problem with the pouring of the liquid. The problem is, where's your bucket? When Elisha came to the woman's home, and she told him that she had nothing left, poverty stricken, nothing. So he said that they were coming to take her children as debt, to settle the debt. So he said to her, what do you have? So she said, one flask of oil. He said, fine, bring it. Bring vessels. Borrow vessels. So the woman went and they brought vessels. And he told her, close the door, and they started pouring. And miraculously, every vessel that they poured was filled. From one small vessel, they filled many. And finally, when they finished all the vessels, he said, have the odd kli, bring another vessel. Ain't no, there was no more vessel. Vayamod Hashem, and the oil stopped. There are many questions here, of course. If you're going to do a miracle, why do you need vessels? Again, you're going to make oil miraculously for the lady. Make the vessels. Yeah. What kind of miracle is this? You make the oil, but only if she provides it. The message is, the miracle's not a problem. The problem is the vessels. The oil's not problematic. He knows what he's pouring down. What? Question is only, where's your vessel?
Even borrowed vessels.
But that was the idea. So there's a natural concept here. That means you provide the vessel, you make the vessel, you open the... On the other hand, it's miraculous. You weren't going to get it otherwise. You say some words. The Medrash says that when Adam came to consciousness, he wasn't in the garden. In fact, the garden hadn't grown. The language in the Torah is Beterem Yitzmach. That means all the plants had grown to the surface of the earth, but they hadn't broken through. We think he came to consciousness in a lush, blossoming world, but it was a desert. The things had grown, but they hadn't broken the surface. Why? Ki Adam Ayin Lavo. There was no man to work the land yet. Now, no work was necessary in that world. So the Medrash says, La avod means avodah shebalev, work of the heart. There was no man to work the world means there was no man to ask for rain. So with his super conscious awareness, he asked for rain, the first prayer in the world. Geshem in Hebrew, you know, doesn't only mean rain. Geshem in Hebrew means rain and all of materialism. Geshem in Hebrew. Geshem, Gashmi in Hebrew, doesn't only mean rain. It means all the material world. And as he asked for rain, it rained and everything grew. So some commentaries say, you see, it was natural. It was meant to be. On the other hand, if he hadn't asked, it wouldn't have happened. So prayer's got this paradoxical... After you ask for it and it's manifest, it then reveals that it was meant to be anyway. So it's natural and miraculous. But let's try just to work through some of this. Let me share with you one idea that is a key to much of this. Not the whole story, there's much more to say. But one key. Let's take one of those questions as a point of focus. You're asking Hashem for something and you're hoping to change his mind. Impossible. Miraculous, impossible, doesn't begin. Here's the key. When you dive into Hashem, you're not trying to change him, you're trying to change you. There's a work on the self here. That's why it's called a sacrifice. Lehit palel means there's something reflexive. There's a judgment of self here. If you can analyze self in prayer, that's why it's such an agonizing effort to pray properly. This is the deepest form of meditation. Before you pray, you should have meditated out of your body. The Nefesh HaChaim says, before you utter the first word, you should have left your body. The old Hasidim used to spend an hour preparing before they started davening. The Gemara says they spent an hour before prayer, they spent an hour in davening, and they spent an hour coming down. It was 9 hours a day on an ordinary day. It was an hour getting up. Getting up, says Nefesh HaChaim, means out of the body. All attachment to the physical is left behind. What the Buddhists call objectless meditation, that opening of consciousness. Then there's the work of tefillah. And then there was an hour coming down. Not coming down, leaving it behind. Coming down, bringing that world into this. Why do you need an hour to, you know, you warm up for exercises, right? So you've got to stretch and warm up. Then they call it warming down afterwards. It wasn't warming down. This was a coming down, coming down into the world, bringing that with you. That was the trick. Staying up there, no problem. But it's coming down into this world, not having left that. And that was a tremendous meditation. The work itself of tefillah was a work of tremendous self-analysis, and the effort is to change the self. That's called avodah shebalev. It doesn't mean only work of the heart. It means the work on the heart. And the key is, you're not trying to change Hashem's mind. The reason you can ask for something and get it is not because he changed, but because you changed. Hashem, I need £100,000. It's bad news for you. It's going to make you insensitive. And now I put myself through a meditation and self-development program. Until I reach the point where that money would be good for me, or good for him, would not take me away, but bring me closer, of course he gives it. Why not? Why not? If the child wants something that a parent knows is dangerous, it's a very useful thing, but it's dangerous. The parent's not going to give it. When the child matures to the point that he can use it correctly, the parent's going to give it. Not because he changed the parent's mind, but because he showed the parent that he's a more mature child. 10-year-old wants an electric drill. He nags his dad for an electric drill. You know what a 10-year-old does electric drill? He drills a hole in the cat. So you give him plastic tools. When the child's mature enough to use power tools, you give him power tools. Didn't change your mind. Changed him. The bigger you are spiritually, the more powerful tools you can be given. You only get given tools in proportion to your power. Of course, your power is what you were originally. You only can long for what you were. Prayer is the cry of the heart to fulfill, to get back to your own inner perfection. The closeness to God, the closeness to Hashem you achieve in tefillah is only a closeness because you evoke more of the original personality. You're talking about a meditation that takes you back into the fetal situation. You've got to go back. Talk about an amazing meditation. You have to discover who you really are in tefillah. Tefillah is a meditation that opens up what your genuine capacity is, which is close to infinite. That's why it's such a tremendous... That's why people who get into this deeply become addicted to it. The Gemara says, has one idea that perhaps we were created only for this. 9 hours a day is nothing when you even feel the ecstasy of that. Standing in front of Hashem means... isn't only an ecstasy of discovering who He is. The first ecstasy is discovering who you're supposed to be. The prayer is not mumbling some words. Texting someone in your pocket, looking at the time, mumbling. It's a travesty. And therefore, there's a self-analysis here. And when you change the self, the new dispensation, of course it's natural. That was waiting to happen. But it's miraculous because changing yourself is nothing short of miraculous. When you open that new awareness, that old awareness, and you get to that new level. The Avos, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, why did they introduce Tefillah to the world? They were the root of perfection. They were Torah in its primal form. Avraham brought the Midah of Chesed to the world. That's what he brought to the world. He began the creation anew after the flood, and humanity had been wiped out. And everybody had gone wrong, and they built a tower with the wrong language, the wrong utterance. They were Dvarim Achadim, Safa Achat, they spoke one language. The language of prophecy, and they used it to divorce the world from its marriage with Hashem. And only one human being stood on the other side. The first quality of being a Jew was to be able to stand on one side against the entire world. That's who he was. And so he introduced the word Avraham is exactly the same. It adds up to 248, all the organs of the body. It says, Eile toldot ha-shamayim va'aretz behi bar'am. These are the generations of the creations of the heaven and earth in their being created. Behi bar'am. Those letters spelled ba'avraham. These are the generations of the creation of the world in Abraham. What does it mean? He was a new creation. He recreated the world. Humanity was brought to the world and wiped itself out, destroyed in a flood. Another 10 generations lived until his generation that went off the rails completely. They weren't wiped out, they destroyed the world spiritually. They crashed the prophetic language. There was one individual who the Medrash says, v'natal schar kulam. He took the reward of all 10 generations that lived before him. It means he was the new format of creation. You know, he was the father of the world, not only of Jews. You know that. He was the father of the world. You know, he had two sets of children, Abraham. Two sets of children. He had children born through Yitzchak, Isaac, Yaakov, that became the Jewish people. And he had souls that he made in Haran. You know that. It says, as a nefesh asher, also, he spread the word. He converted, as it were, people who became spiritually connected to him, who were not Jewish, who did not descend from his line. The world consists of two groups of people today, Jews, who descend from him biologically, spiritually, and the rest of the world who are his children spiritually. All genuine spirituality in the world comes from that original source. When a non-Jew today comes to his senses spiritually and attaches himself to the truth, not Torah, his Torah, his correct morality, he's a child of Avraham. When a person converts to Judaism today, he's allowed to say that he calls himself a son of Avraham. He's son of Abraham. In one sense, it's because he was a soul that got lost from Sinai and found its way back. But at a much deeper level, because he's one of those humans, a soul that was originally brought in, the original kiruv, as it were, the original outreach, was to all humanity. They're always children. The whole world is reformed in his image. And he brings a prayer to the world. What is the prayer? Shachris. When the world goes out on its journey, there's a prayer which is the cry of the soul to go back to its original perfection. Of course he brings that to the world. He is the stage of the world's perfection. The Gemara puts it like this. You have to say, when will my deeds approach those of Avraham Yitzchak? That's what every Jew has to say. Matai yagiu ma'asai. When will my deeds reach ma'asai Avraham Yitzchak, the deeds of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? You have to wake up every morning and say, when will I reach their level? First of all, how can you say that sincerely? When will I reach the level of Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov? You're talking about a person of cosmic greatness that the world was created for him. And secondly, when do we ever do that? The Gemara says it's an obligation. You have to say, as a Jew, when will my deeds reach those of Avraham Yitzchak? Where do you say that? The answer is when you daven Shachris, that's when. The work of Shachris is a longing to get back to who he was. He was the point of perfection. And then the world has disintegrated and devolved, as it were. And every time you daven Shachris, with the unique consciousness of the world beginning its journey, you're going back to that, you're rebuilding that part of your own perfection. Mincha, when you daven Mincha, that is the statement of when will my deeds reach those of Yitzchak. So you're going back to what he represented in the world. The intention should be bringing it all home. Not beginning the journey and expectantly and reaching out, but bringing it all home and acknowledging where it came from. And Ma'ariv, when will I reach the deeds of Yaakov? I mean, that means that cry in the night, that innate longing that comes from the self, not commanded externally, that manifests your true uniqueness and personality. It comes only from within. Is nothing more than a retreat of going back to what he was in the world, that pillar of perfection. And that's why tefillah is such an aching longing. It's a longing for the perfection that you are capable of, that you had once before, that you could be. And that's the potency of its mitzvah. It's not just saying please and thank you or mumbling some words or making a connection. It's the deepest form of meditation. It's opening up the primal, original soul, that primordial consciousness, your own avenue of access to your perfection. The consciousness you should reach in tefillah, properly focused, is should be addictive. It should be a tremendous sadness to detach and come down. The only ability to come down should be because you could bring some of that with you back into the world. And that's... So person doubts. The first thing is you change your relationship with Hashem. The first level of change in the self, you change your relationship. Just speaking to Him changes the relationship. You know, when you ask Hashem for something, the first exercise that you are performing is teaching yourself that that's the right address. When you ask somebody for something, the first thing that happens is you are manifesting explicitly a belief that He's there. When you ask your bank manager instead of Hashem, you manifest a bit. Today is probably a greater act of faith than being to Hashem, but you manifest the belief that He's got the goods to deliver. As Rabbi Miller used to say, no one walks into a grocery shop and asks to buy a piano. They don't sell them there. If you walk into a grocery store, yeah, and you ask for a pair of socks, if you ask the man behind the counter for a pair of socks, you're declaring their belief that that's where they sell them. When you turn to Hashem to ask Him for what you need, the first effort you're doing is refocusing your consciousness of where it comes from. That's a massive change. The second is you change the nature of the relationship. But the deepest level of change, we don't have time to go into it fully now, just to point the direction. The deepest level of change, of course, is changing who you are, and who you are is what you want. And that's why prayer is expressed as desire. Hashem, I want this, I want this, I want this. I need. Ratzon, ratzon. Your desires, as we've discussed many times before, your desires are who you are. What's the real you? Your style? Your tastes? The real inner you is what you want. But the real want, the want that you want for no reason. If you want to know who you really are, ask yourself, what do I really want? What do I really want? Something will pop into your head. It's usually not very complimentary. Okay, why do I want that? So if I had that, I could do. Why do you want that? So if I had that, I could do or be. Why do you want that? Sooner or later, you'll find that there's something you're expressing as your desire that you want for no definable reason. Not because it takes me someplace else, because this is what... That's you. The one thing that you want for no explicable reason, the thing that you want just because you want it, that's who you are. The rest is all methodology, strategy. You may go about it in a more refined way, a less refined way. Last year you did it in a coarse and crude way. Today you walk in a refined fashion, but it's still the same old you. The style is external. The only change you can ever make in who you are, real change, is to want something different. And that's impossible. How can you want something that you don't want? What are you supposed to say, Hashem, I want it? Well, you think, you take three steps forward and you say, Hashem, I just want to be your slave. You're lying through your teeth. You don't want to be a slave. You'd much rather hear where you're a slave. What you really want is to curl up in the sun and go to sleep like a dog. That's what you really want. More or less. So how can you say you want something that you don't want? But the only way you can change it to want something better. The answer is you can't. You can't change it. You can't lift yourself up by your own hair, by your own bootstraps. You can't do that. You can want the new want. Most of us do. Most of us don't want powerfully the burning desire to be better spiritually. But most of us wish we did. Most of us are sensitive enough at least to have the desire for a better desire. At least that. And that should be enough. It should take you to the point where you say, Hashem, I can't honestly say that I want more. I can't honestly say that I want to be closer to you and serve you rather than fulfill myself. But you can get up to that point of self-knowledge and give it away. You can make it transparent. You can say, Hashem, you know what? Take it. It's childish. It's immature. Take it. That you can do. You can't want something new, but you can sacrifice the old. And that's why it's such an agonizing work of meditation. It's reaching the core, the painfully sensitive core. That is what the real you is, the real desire, and saying, Hashem, I'm prepared to give that up. That's called avodah. That's called a sacrifice. That's why tefillah is called a korban. It's called a sacrifice. It's sacrificing the real soul. And then what happens is you get given a gift of a higher one. It's a guaranteed gift. There's no messing around. It's a guaranteed gift. But it's only given on condition that you can give in a way where it's occupying the same space. How do you find the solution to a problem? You can't concentrate on the solution to a problem. You don't have the solution. All you can do is keep the noise out of the way long enough till it falls in. How do you solve a problem? A deep and complex problem. You walk around frustrated until suddenly when you're not expecting it, and usually when you're not concentrating, it's usually when you go to sleep and you wake up in the morning, suddenly you say, I've got it. It's given as a gift. It falls in. Then you have the chutzpah to say, I worked it out. In Yiddish, which is a classical Jewish language, an idea is called an einfall. It falls in. You can't make a new idea. You can only have it happen. All you can do is give away the interference. You have to make the root of personality transparent. You can't shine more light. They're just pure ego. All you can do is keep your own interference out of the way and let the light through. Rav Simcha used to say, the world is full of light except where we cast the shadows. Most of us are trying to be such big deals shining the light, just get in the way. What's written is we have to bring Mashiach, not by bringing Mashiach, but by stop obstructing. Of course, the word means sacrifice of ego. It's not a small matter. The work of tefillah is changing the self most deeply. The reason it's phrased as requests, because though, and that's why you have to mean, I want this most powerfully, but if it's not good, forget about it. Because the real meaning is, I want it for you. Of course I want it for you, because you and I have become one here. My interest is your interest. What do you think it means when it says, make your desire his? It doesn't mean don't have desires. Many Eastern sources teach that to be developed spiritually, you should have no desire. That's not the Jewish idea. To have no desire at all is not being great spiritually, it's being a person who has no inner thought at all, has reached a tremendous level of purity and clarity, but he's a zombie. It's a big step, no one's denying it. But it's a precursor step. In Judaism, you get to that. The concept in Torah is a reconstruction of desire and it's a sublimation of desire. A person who comes to his master and says, Master, I'm your slave, do what you want with me. That's not a slave. Master, push me, pull me, whatever you want, just do with me. That's just a nuisance. A slave, a person comes to his master and he says, Master, I'm burning with ambition. I'm burning with ambition. I have a tremendous ecstasy in expressing what I am. And I'm longing to be all that I could be, but I want to be it for you. That's a slave. We're not talking about a doing away with personality and humor and desire, and we're talking about a sublimation, a channeling of those things, where there's an identification of, and it's not that I don't have desires anymore, but my desires have become his. I want them more powerfully than I did before. And that's why the tefillah is expressed as a rotzon. I want, we want, give us. Give us to use for you, as it were. Then we become one. Anyway, it's getting late. But what we said this evening was, we began to approach the subject of the depth of tefillah, which is changing the self. That means there's an elevation here. There's an excursion beyond the self. There's first of all a self-analysis and self-discovery, a very brutal thing to come to face to face with one's own childishness and ego and personal issues and desires. But that's the effort. It's lehit palel. There's a reflexive exercise here. It begins with leaving the material. It begins with that. And then the work is a tremendous bonding, a tremendous meshing of my desires with his. And in so doing, I get to know him, because I take away the obstruction. And in so doing, I get to know me. And in so doing, I make that statement, when will my deeds reach those of Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov? That means I go back to the point of origin, which is really where I come from and what I was originally. And so the ecstasy of tefillah should be a tremendous communion with self and Hashem in one. There's a real me that's bonding with the real consciousness of what he is. And that is one facet of exploring this paradox. It's a tremendous chesed and a tremendous din. It's that which must be and is miraculous anyway. And that tool is the one that's used to get to know what's called Yud Kei Vav Kei, Hashem, who is the ultimate paradox. He's the source of all oneness and yet is the root of all things. It's a paradox. Part of that paradox is, how can you have free will and he knows before and what's going to be? All these things are not problematic at that level. They're very problematic in the finite world. They can't be resolved in the finite world. Here they're simply phrased as paradox, impossibilities. How can Hashem be truly one and yet the source of all differentiated, fragmented things in the world? How can it be one and have a name that has four specific letters that are... Tefillah is the answer to it. It's an elevation beyond the point of finite consciousness. It's out of the whole Western head of the logical, technological. That is the beginning, and that journey that takes us through history, really. That beginning of the day, middle of the day, expression at night, is a deep cry of the soul for its own discovery of its own fulfillment, which will be the end of the journey and the discovery that that's where the journey began. We'll stop here for now.